Welcome back, everyone, to R2Cast number 162. Last episode we had was with Liz Haynes. Liz Haynes' episode had been one I've been quite interested for a while because it was about neurodiversity in agriculture. And not just, an interest of Liz's. Liz last year was diagnosed with ADHD, which she, in her words, she was always aware there was something, she just hadn't been able to put her finger on it, and she said that helped a lot of things, and in some cases didn't change a lot of things. But it's really quite interesting because certainly working in my line of work, you're working with a lot of students, probably in the ballpark of 110, 120 a year, and because of that, your eyes are opened up to so many things, and neurodiversity, I've said on numerous occasions, is such a brilliant word, I think, and it's a word that has probably made it so much better for a demographic that used to just be called disabled. And I think that is a brilliant thing to happen. So yeah, Liz is doing Nuffield, her Nuffield scholarship this year, one of the same cohort as myself. And yeah, a good episode to go check out there. The next episode we'll have is another Nuffield scholar next week, or the next episode, I should say, with Amy Stoner. Amy is looking at food security, another interesting topic. And I can't exactly say, any of the Nuffield topics aren't interesting because I don't think they'd be Nuffield topics if they weren't. But Amy sort of jumps out to me for the reason that my master's was food security. So yeah, it could be quite cool to have that chat. And today, well, actually, just before we mention today, one more I'll mention is back in episode number 147, me thinking I was really cool, I brought on a snooker player for episode 147, which I thought was hilarious because of the break number, knowing nothing about snooker. But I've also just done the same for darts. So up in 18 episodes from now, we'll have the big 180. And I have currently got two people. I don't actually know who's going to be number 180 at this point, but one person who is the current number 34 in the world, and one person who has been number 4 in the world. So quite interesting. A lot going on the all-in side of things as well. Today on that Nuffield sort of path, I guess. We continue with that. And like I said about Liz and Amy's stories, this is another one that really interests me, and one I got speaking about before the Nuffield conference over a burger and whatever, I can't remember, the night before, which was quite good. And a topic that we speak about a lot on the podcast, but don't really go in too much depth because I think it's very much a big topic. Well, it's not a big topic, it's probably the topic in farming at the minute. But a lot of sort of uncertainty around it, and that's what today's guest Nuffield is on. But before we talk about that, I'm going to pass you on to introduce herself to Hattie McFadgen. Hattie, would you like to say hello?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Wallace. Yeah, everyone, Hattie McFadgen. Don't know what else to say about myself at this point, if I'm honest. I grew up in Cambridgeshire, and as you said, have a kind of career built around sustainability in agriculture, specifically livestock. So yeah, looking forward to being on the podcast.
Just before we get started with another episode of the R2Cast, I would like to thank our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, formerly known as A-Plan Rural. Howden are heavily involved in the social media scene in the ag space with over 100,000 followers on Instagram. They use this following to host social media takeovers with farmers throughout the country to showcase their stories, as well as posting to their rural community blog with further articles about these people in the sector. On top of this, they like to support initiatives that are championing the British agricultural industry, such as myself. So thank you to Howden Rural for that. No, looking forward to having you on. Something really jogged my memory, or not my memory, my mind, I guess, a couple of months ago. Scottish Agricultural Awards came about. There's been the Farmers Weekly Awards, there's been the British Farming Awards and all this sort of stuff. And Scottish Farmer wanted to get involved. Also one of my sponsors here with the podcast, and created the Scottish Farming Awards. It was a brilliant night. But one of the, what would you call it, categories was called Sustainable Farm of the Year. And someone had commented saying, this shouldn't be a category. This should just be the case. And I was like, yes, never considered that. Now, considered it on the basis that that should be the case, but never fully sort of put like a sort of thought to it. And it's true. I think, we talk about sustainability and we talk about agriculture, and a lot of people talk about those two things in silos, which they really shouldn't be. They should just be together. I mean, it's kind of mad that there's the concept of unsustainable agriculture out there, when did that interest come about, Hattie? Because you weren't raised on a farm or anything like that. Where did that come from?
So yeah, you're right. I grew up in Cambridgeshire, not on a farm. Both of my parents did grow up on farms, So was very much inspired by them. They talk about it very positively. Spent my summers either visiting granddad on his farm, or up with my aunt who's up in kind of North Yorkshire. Very much still integrated with that kind of thing. So there was always like a love for agriculture and farming and that kind of thing. And I know that I view it with rose-tinted glasses because I've never had to pull the long days or anything like that. So that love of agriculture was really what started it all. I think I was in the very common case for a lot of people that grew up on farm that I didn't realize I could get into farming when I was younger. So I actually went down the economics route, did my degree in economics. At the end of that degree, kind of realized that I didn't want to go into finance. I didn't want to be a banker. I'm not driven by that. But took a couple of modules on climate economics and environmental economics and how the economy changes when there are scarce resources around, which I really found fascinating. It's that combination of, the love that you have for agriculture and the environment and this like fear that it's all gonna go up in flames one day, which thankfully I now have a more balanced view on what might happen. But went through that way, entered it really, I've got a master's of climate science and re kind of positioned myself to join agriculture from that perspective, really, to marry the two together.
There must be a lot of people I've had on this podcast. I mean, probably think of four or five in the last 20 episodes where people have went to uni to do something, whatever, and they've had one or two modules and they're like, I quite like that. And it's just completely changed their path, like completely. And not completely, but in some cases completely, in some cases kind of. What was climate science masters like? Because that could be interpreted in a lot of ways. What did that involve?
It did go through the science of carbon cycle and how to model changes that might happen to our kind of our climate in the UK, for example, which also feeds into where I am with Nuffield now. But it also looked at, how do countries who obviously we developed with the Industrial Revolution, and that was very carbon heavy. What opportunities are there for countries to develop in a green way? And the politics of that and the conversations involved in that as well. So it was very much balanced science with kind of the policy side of things as well.
It is an interesting topic because it's climate science isn't one, well, it certainly wasn't a term I had heard as a, I'm not going to say kid because I wasn't really into master stuff when I was a kid, but even when I was at degree level in agriculture, certainly maybe I was hidden from it in that agriculture wasn't at that stage embarrassingly as a sector 10 years ago. But it certainly wasn't a thing that I'd come up with, I'd really been aware of. And I think we've had four or five people with that master's on the podcast now, and it just feels like one of those masters that must be ever growing, very quickly growing. A lot of people taking that on and sort of moving into that space. How did the discussions go? You said it was always sort of put in a positive light from your parents. Your parents been brought up in farming, but not now in it. Did I've come from a farm that also my parents are obviously on the farm, and I'm always quite interested in that. Well, my parents aren't from this, but they're still making me want to go there. Did they actively make you want to do that, or was it just, oh, that sounds nice?
No, they I mean they never pushed it. They're quite surprised that I'm now in this sector. I mean, they're happily surprised. My older brother is currently in New Zealand and has worked on farms and that kind of thing. So they're both of them are quite surprised that, they've left the farm, but both of their kids has end up in the sector again. It was more, what it's like, your parents are telling stories at the dinner table and that kind of stuff. So there was no sugarcoating on what it was like. Some of the stories are quite tough and that kind of thing as well. But I think it was the ability. It takes up so much of the conversation in kind of family reunions and when you're visiting family, It was definitely like a bit of a happy place to be running around making tea for whoever on farm and seeing the cows and everything like that. So I think it was just embedded that way. And then it's kind of you care about it because it's part of your family and your heritage and that kind of thing. I definitely, if I could redo my journey up until this point, I would still want to be in the same position, but I would have wanted to, spend a few years on farm, particularly a dairy farm, to really get that side of it as well. But you never know. Maybe I'll do that in the future for a few years.
A career shift. You mentioned the sort of rose-tinted glasses at the start, which I think is a real th I mean, like, it is a real thing, and it
Yeah.
sort of plays into the whole what's the term, grass is always greener, you know. Oh, that sounds fun, everything I see about this thing's perfect, but in truth you're not seeing it all. When you saw it all and you began to realize of, I don't want to say the bad stuff, but just the stuff that isn't, you know, promoted as the perfect reality,
Yeah.
did that hit you and you were like, oh, this is different, or were you just, this is just, this is how it goes, this is it?
Yeah, definitely. It's something I still worry about today, really, because I mean, in my job, I meet a lot of farmers and I go on farm most weeks and we're having a chat and a cup of tea and looking around and stuff. And there's a lot of stress. There's a lot of stress that people are dealing with, which I think it continually surprises me. Just, I mean, I know that we've had exits and that kind of thing, and it's a massive shame. And I'm not surprised about those exits because of the amount of stress that we hear about. I mean, labor, rising input costs, but policy changes or new requirements from retailers and processors and that kind of thing. It can add a lot, can't it? Because, I mean, with farming, you don't log off. You don't log off and then think about something else. It's always there. So yeah, it always surprises me, but I think going back when when I was older and asking my parents, well, why didn't you go into farming, or why did granddad stop milking cows and go to sheep and then eventually go to arable? And it was all kind of industry pressures, which again has led me to sustainability. Like we talk about sustainability a lot of the times, we talk about carbon. That's a whole different conversation. I do really believe in carbon accounting and that kind of thing. Also because it's so highly linked to cost effectiveness. They're so correlated. But also we need to extend sustainability, as you were saying before, to include financial sustainability, labor sustainability, like all of these things. So yeah.
There's a massive weight, and I think, you know, at the time of recording, this will be a few weeks ago by the time this episode's released. Is it Aid Apitan, I think the guy's name is, the Paralympic basketball player, has I think, what was the name of the TV show? I can't remember. It was basically slamming the beef industry, and sort of saying chicken's better than it. I'll be honest, Hattie, I don't watch TV. My students come in and get angry at me, and we have a chat, and I sort of look into things. But yeah, I mean, what, how many sectors are in a position that a nice TV show can come on and absolutely slam what you're doing? When, you know, 99% of the tech, there's issues. Of course, there is. There's a lot of issues, and we'll have to work on that. And there's bad eggs, like there is, you know, everywhere. But yeah, it's just, it is tough, and it's kind of, yeah, it is a bit worrying to when you think about that, isn't it? You know, you look at the rose-tinted glasses, and I'll be honest, when I prefaced that question, I was probably more thinking of, did you see issues with welfare or sustainability and whatever? But really, what you're talking about is that sort of humanitarian level. Like, we've got to consider that farmers are people, and farmers are out there, and it's a lot of weight, absolutely. And it's something that mental health and agriculture has been become a pretty major movement for all the right reasons. I mean, we're seeing, I think, as an industry, embarrassing numbers of mental health issues that are leading to pretty serious things, you know. And yeah, you're absolutely right. I would just like to quickly interrupt the show for a minute to give you some extra information about our primary sponsors, Howden Rural, the new name for A Plan Rural. Howden Rural provide bespoke insurance cover for farms and estates. This could be for anything from tractors and machinery to a new exciting diversification venture. Be sure to check out Howden Rural today. It's, I think I've had quite a lot of people on the podcast now, at least 162. I would guess well in advance of 200 because I've grouped podcasts and stuff. But I don't think of anything I've ever had someone that's done this, and I'm going to say it and then I'll be wrong. It'll be quite embarrassing. But I think I'm right in saying you spent some time in, is it Myanmar, Myanmar,
Yeah.
Burma, whatever, you know. First off, a absolutely fascinating country. From what I understand, like now, my knowledge of the world is based on capital cities and reading into all this stuff, and I absolutely can never pronounce its capital city. But is it Jaipur? I'm going to say it wrong. Anyway, don't matter. They basically created this phenomenally progressive city, but no one seems to use it. No one seems to be there. Yeah, that's my understanding. Is that right, or is that completely
Yeah, so it's called Naypyidaw.
yeah, Jaipur was close enough, but not great.
Naypyidaw is it's the government capital, it's the official capital. But you only go there if you have a meeting with government. So it's this very weird set out with everything. You can't walk to anything, it's drivable. There's a building, and then 5 minutes down the road there's another building. It's very scarce, but you have
Okay.
these big buildings there that are government departments, and then the hotels that service ministers who, and there are houses there as well. But yeah, and they have these multi-lane highways. I think there's about 8 lanes or something like that, that of no traffic, no build up, anything like that. So it's quite interesting. I think the military government built it in the last coup, so they could have Naypyidaw, but obviously everything else goes on in Yangon, where I lived. That's the kind of economic capital kind of
And
thing.
why is that? Is Naypyidaw just extortionate or what? Like, I mean, for my understanding was they had a, I don't want to say dictator if that's wrong, but they had a leader that was a bit crazy from my understanding and basically made policies to make life difficult. It seemed to be what, yeah, is that great? And then, yeah, progressing on to this, what from the outskirts and from looking down on a drone or whatever just looks like this mega progressive city.
Yeah.
Is it expensive or is it just you don't go there because you get in trouble or what's the reason?
I think it's more because, I mean, culturally, Yangon is the capital city. It has been for a long time. So you have as such a, people who have been there for generations, of course, and it's very densely populated. And then when you suddenly kind of build a city, I think it takes a while for businesses to move, because they're like, hang on, all the people are in Yangon, which I think is the main reason. There's obviously a lot of other political sensitivities. If you don't necessarily like the military government, then you're probably not gonna go over there either, and stay in Yangon. So yeah, I'm definitely no political commentator on the country, but I don't see Naypyidaw becoming the new Yangon anytime soon.
How far apart are these two cities?
They're a day trip,
Oh,
if I
right,
remember
okay.
correctly. Yeah, it was definitely I didn't go there a lot. I think I went there 3 times over the 2.5 years or something like that, and only to meet kind of farming and fisheries government ministers and things like that. But yeah. It's quite a way.
What's the language there?
The majority language is Burmese,
Right.
and then you have, so it's a country built up of a lot of states, which if you'd drawn the boundaries different, you would have different kind of majority languages. But yeah, the majority is Burmese.
Are you fluent in Burmese?
I'm absolutely not. I got to an okay level, like conversationally, but yeah, it's been, how long has it been now? 2 years or something since I went there, and I definitely haven't kept it up, unfortunately.
And what's the reason? Because you speak to, you know, like our parents, they would all say Burma, and in my head it's always been, and I never know if I'm saying it right, if it's Myanmar or Myanmar. But why is that? Did that happen with that coup as well, or?
So it did. I still use Burma, to be fair, because so Burma was the name decided by General Aung San, which is very much the people's hero of Burma. Then the military coup happened, And it was kind of like that stamp of this is we are ruling this country now. Let's change the name. So a lot of people actually believe that Myanmar is different. I'm going to butcher this explanation so much, but it's actually something to do with the phonetic spelling of Burma or something like that, that is actually not that different from Burma,
Right.
which is quite interesting. But so some people like Myanmar because Burma's name originated from the Bamar ethnicity, which is the majority ethnicity. So some people like Myanmar because, it's more representative of different ethnicities that make up Myanmar.
Right.
And then some people criticize it because they're like, actually, it's not that different, not that different a name. So yeah, that's the two.
There we are. Oh, I just as you were saying that, I was Googling the exact same thing. And yeah, I mean, like up until probably about 17 seconds ago, I thought Myanmar was the new name. You know, I thought it, yes, you might still say Burma, but I thought it never existed before whenever this all happened. Yeah, in practice, however, both terms have been used for centuries. Burma became the country's official name under colonial rule and stuck after independence. We use primarily in spoken language, whereas Myanmar was the formal term generally used in written communication. Yeah. Learn something every day. And it's, you know, if you were to ask again, I'm sort of referring back to times purely based on parents' age, which is a really weird thing to do, but I'm doing it anyway. If I was to mention Burma to my mom and dad, they'd probably think of turmoil, pretty tough times. Is that just not the case now? Is it a really nice place to live for?
No, so unfortunately, it was open again, and that's when I moved there, and Aung San Suu Kyi was democratically elected leader, but then unfortunately the pandemic, the coup happened again, so she's now under house arrest, and there was massive conflict, which I had left 2 months before that, not knowing a coup was going to happen. So for a lot of Burmese friends and that kind of thing, it was a bit of a tough time. It's settled down now, but there is still big resistance to the coup happening. So yeah, there was a period of kind of open trade, people going over and living there, and vice versa. But unfortunately now it's regressed into dictatorship again.
And yeah, I'm going to butcher the name. Ansung Shi, is that right?
Aung San Suu Kyi.
Suchi, yeah. So it's like KYI, isn't it? Yeah, right. Okay, so I've been saying that entirely wrong. She was good though, wasn't she? She was.
Yeah,
Yeah.
she was for the majority good. I think a lot of people weren't impressed with how she handled, sorry, this is going to go into a really dark place,
No,
but
go. It's interesting. Eh? It's really.
how she handled the genocide of the Rohingya people. So
Right.
the Rohingya people are a group of Muslims who live in West Rakhine, and unfortunately, a genocide occurred whilst I was there. But it had been building for decades, and she didn't. I think a lot of people, because she's always been a freedom fighter, thought that she would maybe extend that courtesy to the Rohingya. Unfortunately, was very quiet about it. So people then, got a bit of a difficult view. Now obviously the coup has happened, so there is a greater evil happening. So a lot of people look to Aung San Suu Kyi again for that freedom fighting. But yeah, there's a lot of kind of Burmese activists that definitely sum it up way more eloquently than I can. But yeah, it was quite interesting when she came to power and handled those conflicts.
So if you or I were interested to go there currently, would that just be not
I wouldn't
possible?
advise it.
You would advise it, it'd be that sort of thing, yeah,
Yeah,
right?
not at all. I have had some friends who have gone for work. But yeah, is on the tourism, it's also kind of, it's that really hard line between, if I can go, you would be supporting, the tourism industry there, which is struggling. However, the military tax so many goods, you're also kind of supporting military dictatorship. So it's a bit of a yeah, I would personally recommend against it, but as soon as it's open, I would hugely recommend visiting. It's an absolutely beautiful country. The people are absolutely lovely. The cuisine is incredible if you're a foodie, because it's situated in between Thailand, China, Bangladesh, and India, so it borders all of
Good
them.
places.
Yeah, so you can see, like, if you travel around, you can absolutely see those influences. Yeah, Burmese cuisine is yeah, one of the best in my opinions.
It's would you go as far as saying, when you came back was lucky timing, but
Very lucky timing.
you would have struggled to get out, or?
I would have struggled to get out. Yeah, I would have gotten out, because they did put flights on for people trying to escape, but there was a period of time where there was just absolute rioting all over the place, especially in the place where I lived, Sanchang. So it would have been a struggle. I think a lot of people, obviously my local friends over there, just had to hunker down and kind of wait it out, and then friends from kind of Europe and America, it we're in the same boat. You just have to kind of stay inside until fighting kind of stops, and then get to the airport type of thing. So it was, yeah, it's a bit touch and go for a lot of people.
That's scary. That's not nice
Yeah.
at all. And more positively,
Yeah.
one, I think in August I went to Rwanda and Tanzania, right? And everyone was like, how? How did that happen? And I think more than in particular focus on, well, both of them are tourist hubs, really. Tanzania in particular, and then Rwanda growing, obviously very similar to Burma, faced a horrible genocide as well at one point. But how, why Burma, how does that happen, how does that happen?
You know what? It was just lucky, if I'm honest. I was kind of sitting writing my dissertation one day, and we had this like forum page on our kind of university portal, and I saw a job advert for a consultancy company, actually in Vietnam. They were advertising for a position in Hanoi to work with farmers, to kind of evaluate how international funds were being spent to promote climate resilience. And I thought, well, this is an amazing opportunity. Kind of applied whilst being stressed out about my dissertation, and then got so much more stress because I'd got it. And so yeah, handed in my dissertation, and 10 days later I was kind of sitting in Hanoi, thinking, my God, what am I doing? But really excited about it. Spent 6 months in Vietnam until they said, we've got a position open in our Yangon office in Burma. Do you want to go? And I, yeah, couldn't get there fast enough. So yeah.
Vietnam, I know Thailand's almost a bit like Venice, isn't it? A gorgeous place that's almost been polluted by the addiction of people going there. But Vietnam and Thailand, their geology is stunning, like utterly st I'm not talking Hanoi, I don't actually know where I'm talking. I don't know the names of the places, but rural, some of the sort of coastal based places are just utterly stunning. Is Burma, I'm not really good in the geography over there. Is Burma landlocked?
No, it's got
No.
sea to the south,
Right.
and it has quite a long kind of, I don't know what you call it,
A long coastline, or no? Like a
and it
peninsula out.
kind of juts out
Ah,
very
right.
far into the sea. As well, so it's got a lot of like very good fish cuisine, and everything like that, which is really good.
Yeah, it's a similar shape to India, isn't it? It's a different size, but yeah. And then tell us about your role in Burma as well.
So yeah, it was very much the same thing. So international funds would flow into the country and be spent on agriculture in one way or another, and they wanted a company to kind of evaluate whether it worked, whether the resilience had improved, talking like saline resilient rice varieties and that kind of thing. It wasn't a lot of it wasn't much livestock over there because it's very subsistence, But Arable was more kind of on a larger scale, which was really interesting. You just got to tour Burma, and speak to farmers about, you know, how it was going and that kind of thing. A couple of projects was also trying to design the kind of next stage, which I found more interesting, to say, look, what are your problems here? And it was in Rakhine State, so it's coastal. And they were getting a lot of flooding instances that were just destroying the health of the soil. It was just too much saline to plant anything or grow anything. So it's kind of like, what can we do on an infrastructural level here to provide some protection?
Right.
So,
Wow.
yeah.
Yeah, there weren't many folk that have done
Yeah.
that. It's pretty cool. That's amazing. It's funny, isn't it? I think I found myself in the eternal dissertation stress twice because I've done two. You'll have done the same. And I always seem to find myself putting so much intricate time into stuff like not a Burmese job application, not at all, but you know, that sort of thing. I don't know, it was like intense procrastination. How much did you just do? A ridiculous amount of well thought out work that wasn't my dissertation. And then you find yourself coming back, as you said, in good time. And I'm right in saying it was in good time, not even from a Burma perspective, but also from a COVID perspective, but just before,
Yeah,
is that right?
I flew in on the Sunday and we locked down on the Tuesday.
Oh, right. Okay, right. Jeez, yeah, fair.
Yeah, I saw
Okay.
that. I kept seeing the news getting worse and worse, and I was like, maybe it's time. Maybe I need to fly home and settle in the UK, get a job and that kind of thing.
Well, see, it's funny. You hear this a lot. Folk are like, you know, oh, I did this and did that, and then I thought I had to settle. I sort of settled from uni, and now I'm like, we're gonna go. You know, yeah, it's funny how everyone lives sort of the opposite. But and is it right? You're with a company called ProMars, is that right? ProMars.
Yes, yeah, Promar International.
ProMars.
Yeah, I took a little hiatus before Promar, if I'm honest. I didn't quite know where I wanted to go. I wanted to get out of the kind of moving abroad in developing countries career, because I think it's hard to progress there without being problematic.
For sure. Yep.
Local expertise, and you need to be raising local expertise up and supporting that, and to build a career in that space is really difficult to do if you are conscious about that. So I knew I wanted to go into agriculture. I knew it want I wanted to it to be kind of sustainability or climate related. And it took me, I was doing other things for 6 months, and then I saw this position at Promar. Who have kind of traditionally been a dairy consultancy, but that's underselling them really to say that they've got a lot of expertise. I don't know how many of us there are now, but we're a big group. And then they have the sustainability team, which sits kind of alongside the farm consultants teams. And yeah, once I heard about what they were doing and where they wanted to go, I was like, yeah, this is the place for me. So thankfully I got that job as well. So that's always the, sorry.
Sorry, on you go, on you go.
It's always the, you know, when you kind of look at a company and what they're doing and say, oh yeah, I really want to join them. I really want to get involved. And you kind of get your heart set on the application and that kind of thing. But thankfully it came out good. So.
And tell us about that position. What's involved?
So yeah, we kind of sit in between, policy retailers and farmers. So we work very closely to, sorry, it's just retailers and processors. So we work very closely to dairy and beef and lamb processors, who want to understand A, what their scope three emissions are, so which really means farmers, the emissions of the farms that feed into the processors. B, how we can give farmers tools to reduce carbon intensity. And again, when I say that, it's also tools to improve cost efficiency. And then also kind of keep our eye on policy to see what's coming in the future and what, you know, where we need to get going and get our gears going as an industry to stay on top of these changes so that we don't get caught out by it. Comes back to that stress level again. if we kind of have the tools that we need to prepare for things coming our way, then it's a less stressful time. So
This question's purely based on the fact that I don't think there'll be many folk in the country that speak for a longer period of time to people in farming than myself and a few others. And there's a pretty underlying fear of what does this mean? You know, like carbon, I think we all agree we want to minimize and in some cases optimize carbon, but minimize our production. But things like carbon credits and the I don't know if it's scaremongering or general reality that, you know, that the sort of quote unquote billionaires of the world will be able to buy up your credits and you won't be able to, is there are we leading into a scary time from a carbon perspective, or are we leading into a good time?
But in terms of carbon credits and the
Yeah.
carbon credit market, I'm a bit scared of it, if I'm honest.
Right.
I think it's a bit of a wild west out there at the minute. There are some good prices for carbon stocks being chucked around the place, which I think is very exciting. If you're a farmer and you say, actually, yeah, I'm definitely sequestering and I can definitely change some of my practices. I might go from ploughing to min-till, and then I can sequester this much more carbon, and then I can sell that for a really good price. I'm nervous of the contracts that come with that, because in order for it to be done properly, that's it. Then you lock in that carbon. You can't do anything to kind of release that carbon. But what happens if, if things change on your farm and you need remedial tillage and that kind of thing? Yeah, there are a lot of people moving into that carbon trading, carbon credit space, but honestly, I wouldn't touch it with a barge pole if I. Yeah, at the minute, it's just a bit of a scary one.
Biological cryptocurrency.
Yeah. I mean, like all the carbon capture and storage stuff, they have this rock weathering, which is, you take in carbon and you store it in rocks, effectively. I've probably butchered that definition. But, that's different to us working with the soil. Like active carbon is, we have the carbon cycle, it naturally releases carbon, and hopefully it's taking in more than it's releasing, which if we're looking after our soils, it should be, for the most part now. And I just think hanging on to that, you can chase improving carbon in your soil, and it's something that we talk about a lot on a day-to-day basis. But at the end of the day, in order to do that, you're just looking after your soil health. And what farmer doesn't want to will look after their soil health? So I think chasing that is really good, because it will give back. Locking yourself into a carbon credit contract, I'm not so sure about.
Yeah, and it's one of those things, like in my head, and I don't think this will be anywhere near being finalized, but in my head it's a, you know, when you get that payment, when you whatever, it feels like a one-off thing to me. It doesn't feel like you can farm sequestration. Now, I'm guessing, given your topic, you were at the speech of the Nuffield conference this year on can you farm carbon? You know, I feel like the way carbon credits will go is no, you can't, because I feel like it's going to be a, you've sort of sold your quota is not the word, I don't know what the word is. Sorry, you've sold your ability to sequester carbon this one time, and I can't see that continuing. I could be completely wrong, and I think in fairness, I hope I probably am. But does that then lead to the incentive of, right, I've sequestered this carbon, let's release a ton and then put more back in? Like, I don't know what the, I don't know how that works.
Yeah.
Feels a bit reductive, but
Yeah, I mean, hope this is where these contracts, the contracts are trying to, get you to not release that carbon, so to kind of lock it in. There are so many techniques that we can do that will, I mean, it'll take 20 years probably before we will be, that we've definitely sequestered carbon here. Like, we always give a 5-year figure, and that's what we work to. We usually soil sample about 20% of a farm every year. So over a five years, you have a rolling average, and you can see your carbon in the soil increasing. But what we're not, I think we're not what we're not very good at is understanding what's the status quo. So the status quo of our farming could be carbon sequestration. And like, this is coming from a perspective, I believe that farmers should get paid for public goods. Like, I'm a massive supporter of that. Like, we work so closely to the environment and we do a lot of good. we should get paid for that public good that we're producing, and part of that public good is carbon sequestration. So I'm definitely up for farmers getting paid for the good that they're doing here. It's that contractual, I will do this, and then for 100 years, I will have to keep doing this, and succession plans, tenant farmings, all of that thing is just an absolute muddle.
Yeah, it is. And to be honest, public goods, carbon's arguably one of the easiest things in public good to quantify. Like, it's that's the tricky thing. You know, how do you in a glaring general sort of stereotype, the quote unquote farmer on the ground's probably going to know less than the person offering the contract, and there's the worry, well, can you easily get taken advantage of here? But yeah, it's an interesting one. It's a really interesting one, which sort of puts us in quite nicely, Hattie, to Nuffield. Why Nuffield? Where did you hear of that, and how did it come to be?
Yeah, I heard of it through an ex-colleague, actually, Duncan Williams, who did his Nuffield a few years ago. I'd always heard about Nuffield, but it takes a conversation with someone to say, "Oh, go for it. This is, you're interested enough in your topic and that kind of thing to really go for it." So I took a bit of persuading to get over the imposter syndrome of even applying. I heard that it was an absolutely amazing experience, that if you were driven about a subject, you need to do enough field, because the kind of support that you get to go chase something you're really interested in is unlike any other, really. So that's ultimately it. So I stuck my application in, and here I am, really.
What is your topic? What's it on?
It's on resilience, particularly around climate volatility. So how do we enhance our resilience as the dairy sector in the UK, if we're going to be experiencing more instances of droughts, more heat stress, more flooding, more climate volatility? How do we prepare ourselves for that? How do we learn from farmers who are already operating profitably under those conditions?
And on that, climate volatility, is that linked with, like we spoke about earlier, financial volatility as well, or is it strictly looking from a climate perspective?
It will touch upon financial volatility in the sense that it's got a supply chain kind of aspect to it. So, I mean, we saw the Russia-Ukraine conflict massively change prices. Obviously, climate crisis, climate change is a global phenomenon. It's not just going to happen in the UK. So I definitely want to have a look at how supply chains might kind of look in the future. That's going to impact our finances, but also I think I need to do a bit of a baselining scope of the UK. So what will we look like by 2050? And that's obviously going to have a lot of impacts on our financial sustainability as well.
And one question I love to ask folk is, where's that going to take you?
In geographically,
Career-wise, probably a lot of places, but yeah, geographically.
geographically, so I'm going to go to US, India, and Mexico to particularly look at heat stress, and they will hopefully give me a different kind of balance of infrastructure levels, herd size, genetics, that kind of thing. And then I'm going to go to the Netherlands for flooding infrastructure and that kind of thing. And then Cuba, which I know is a bit of an odd one, but we look at supply chain instability. Where else to kind of look at,
Yeah, true.
agriculture under supply chain instability than Cuba, who's obviously had to operate under an embargo for the past however many years. So,
I hope you've kicked your feet up and got comfy and enjoying another fantastic episode of the R2 Cast with another really interesting guest. I would just like to quickly take another second to plug the sponsors of the show today, the Scottish Farmer, and I would strongly advise you to go out and pick one up this week and see even more of the fantastic people that are in our industry.
I've never understood that.
I kind of get how and why it came about, but I just don't get how that can still be the case. I don't get that.
It's odd, isn't it? It's just hang-ups from things in the past, I guess. But Yeah, it's quite interesting because I mean I'm not the most knowledgeable. Like over these 2 years, I will gain a deeper understanding of what it's like. But it's just so interesting that they've had a lot of kind of dairy targets and goals as a country. Like we will produce good kind of Cuban dairy, a good Cuban dairy sector, and it's not really come to fruition. And it's how kind of linked that is to supply chain instability and that kind of thing, which I'm really excited to kind of look at and explore.
And even away from Nuffield, you'll have to take a day to go to Havana just to see the fact it's still 60 years ago. Like, so interesting. I've got a mate, he's actually, if you're interested, he's actually, I believe, between him and his partner, they've been to 89 countries. Yeah, and they were just in Cuba last month, and oh, it's just like, it's just what you think of the films in the 60s and 70s. Like, it's just as if it's still the Cold War, like the cars and everything. It's quite interesting. But yeah, Netherlands, who else could you possibly go to from the flood topic? I mean, geez, they literally built a place. But everyone seems to go to New Zealand. Sorry, goes to US. Everyone seems to go to US. And at first it annoyed me. I'm like, why? But like, why can't we just, there's so many countries out there. And then I went there last month and I'm like, ah, okay. It has everything. I mean, it's obviously not small, not the biggest country in the world, but it has everything. I mean, it's quite insane. So what was that? USA, Mexico, India, that'll be interesting. Were you in, I don't want to say hop over because I understand it's not next each other, but were you in India or no?
I went a couple of times, but only to I convinced my parents instead of me flying home to the UK, come visit and we'll meet in India and
Oh,
spend a couple of weeks there, which was good. But I haven't actually chosen regionally where to go in India, so I'll have a bit of a look into that and see where it'll do best.
it's quite interesting because I mean India was well, for me, I used to be a bit of a atlas geek who would read capital cities and populations and stuff. And I always remember India being 960 million when China was 1.18 billion. And yeah, so almost quarter of a million behind, and now it's number one, and that's in my lifetime. Now that atlas was maybe from before my lifetime, but the growth rate from a population perspective is still exponential. I don't know when, I haven't looked at a graph to see when it looks like that'll plateau, but it just never seems to show any signs of stopping. And with that, supply chains must be under complete stress, complete strain, sorry. That'll be interesting. That will be interesting. And this is maybe a sort of stereotype again. And I think I used to say I shouldn't say stereotypes, but now I do because I think they're stereotypes for a reason. A lot of people probably think them. Countries like India, in my head, probably aren't focusing on sustainability hugely. Maybe that's completely wrong. That'll be quite interesting to see. Because number one priority is feeding at that point. That's gotta be. It's gotta be more important, I think. Yeah, or does it? I don't know. It's a tricky one. It really is a tricky one. How long are you planning going to India? India's a fascinating place.
I think maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks, I think. I need to be, I mean, Promar have a massively supportive of my Nuffield journey, which I can't, that I can't fault. It's been really good. But obviously balancing as well. I need a good amount of time to research Nuffield and I need a good amount of time to do my day job.
Yeah, that's it.
But I think about, a week and a half, and I'm particularly interested in the co-op. Cooperative models over there because they're all kind of cooperative dairies, which is quite interesting. So yeah, I'll hopefully chat to some co-ops and then some farmers as well. So I'm really excited.
Amazing, amazing. Are you looking at doing the like the Aberystwyth thing? The
Yes,
yeah,
yeah,
no,
the
PG Chair.
conversion.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I'm yet to kind of take the taster couple modules to see if I can fit it in an average week. But I think it's such a good opportunity to convert the Nuffield into potentially a master's. So
You've done a fair chunk, haven't you? So,
yeah.
yeah, get another master's, certain at least another PG cert. I've got one of each. I might as well try and double up on one of them. That's it. No, here, Hattie, good stuff. It's really interesting. Do you know, I've really enjoyed filming with everyone. For those listening, this actually we're actually 15 minutes late in recording, which was completely my fault. Hattie asked earlier if I was a foodie, and the reason I was late was because I was cooking. But one thing I've really enjoyed was, you know, we I guess by the nature of Nuffield, it's progressive folk. Yeah, feels weird saying that when I am one of them, but you know what I mean. And just speaking to everyone that, you know, we're just daft folk in a group chat. You know, that's all we are. That's all we are to me at the minute. And then you meet each other at a Nuffield conference, and even then, it's still the case because we're still kind of not really involved this week. It's just a bit of fun and whatever. But actually getting down and sitting chatting for an hour and being like, "Jeez!" Like, first off, I probably focused on Burma a lot. I apologize. Really interesting to me. Yeah, looking forward to the report. And I think there's no way I could read every Nuffield report on the planet, but I think I probably will read all of ours because I feel like I'm part of it all now, you know, which is really nice. But before we finish off, Hattie, there's two questions I ask everyone. No one gets away without them. I absolutely hate the first. I think it's a horrible question, but I ask everyone it. The first one is, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And the second one is, if you had any advice for people coming into farming, what would it be?
I should have been prepared to this for this, listening to
Yeah.
you well, shouldn't I? But 5 years, I love what I do. I love speaking to farmers. I like finding solutions which are cost effective. I want to do that on maybe I want to work with people more, like networks more. I think I personally don't work with new entrants enough, like youth. I think getting on platforms and really learning from everyone is key. So I hope I'm in a similar position, more of an expert about topics that I absolutely love and I love to chat about, and I hope I'm chatting to more people about them, if I'm honest. So that will be my 5 years. The second one,
Like advice or tips for people coming
I think I would go for something that I didn't do, and it's walk up farm drives and say, as you know, when you're younger, and say, what can I do on a weekend when I'm not at school, or what can, you know, just get out there and get some experience on farm. I think obviously I'm coming from a position of somebody that hasn't done that, but I wish that I'd done it, because I think it's an amazing experience, and you know, you can't learn it from a textbook. And if you're passionate about food, passionate about sustainable food and agriculture, where else to start than go get out there and really do something practical on farm.
Do you know, it's funny you say that. The first person we ever filmed with, well, no, not true. First person I ever started interviewing, I didn't film with them because it started as written interviews for 26 episodes, was Flavio Nobiero. And that was the first bit of advice that was ever given. It's been the same question every time. And he said that's what he'd done. You know, came from Kenya, 14, I think he was. And his words were, you know, just this random Kenyan lad going up farms trying to find a job, and someone took him on, and now look at him. You know, he was all over posters at the Nuffield conference, you know. Yeah, nah, it's a great way, and I don't think people realize the power of that. You know, there's so much, you know, I've sort of created a career off of social media and stuff, and that's got a power, but the impact it has on a single person, you going and being like, look, what's the cracks or anything I can help with, is amazing. So yeah, no, absolutely. No, listen, Hattie, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been
Been an
fun
absolute.
to chat.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'll be honest, until about 10 minutes before, when I was making that pork there and having a look at your Nuffield story, I didn't think I was going to come into Burma today, I'll be honest. So yeah, really, really cool chat, and thank you for sharing that. For those of you listening, as I said earlier, the next episode will be with Amy Stoner. Amy looking at food security and her Nuffield story, which will be good there. The next one will be the episode after that will be, yes, Kate Rawls. So many of you know, and Hattie just mentioned Ukraine. I think the first time I ever spoke to Hattie, I was in Ukraine. And I was like trying to arrange some, I was basically in the passenger seat of the pickup at that point, trying to arrange the podcasts when I was in the passenger seat. Arranged four or five, realized the time zones were different and had to start all over again when I came back. With being in Ukraine, I spent about 1,400 miles with a lovely chap called Bill Rawls. And albeit Bill and I have spent a total of about 4 days together, I think he'll always have a special place in my heart because of that journey we experienced together. But Bill, we got chatting, turned out his son had w listened to my podcast and all this, and that was fine. And he said, "Oh, my sister's got a really cool story." And I was like, "Okay, cool. What's this?" You know, I'll be honest, quite a lot of people hear you've got a podcast and someone's got a cool story. And then it turns out, I'm like, I don't think I've got an episode out of that. But oh my God, I haven't filmed this. I'm going to be filming it in 45 minutes' time. I would strongly advise you listen to 164 as well, which will be Kate Rawls' story. I haven't filmed it yet, but I have an idea of what her story involves. And all I'm going to say is she cycled the height of South America in a bike she built out of bamboo. There's more to it. There's a lot more to it, but that's a small part. So, yeah, quite an interesting woman. But today's episode with Burma Carbon and the future of Nuffield was with Hattie McFadden. So, very much another great episode there. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you for the next episode, number 163, with Amy Stoner. See you then. I hope you've enjoyed another excellent episode of the R2 Cast as much as I have. And I would just like to quickly thank our primary sponsors of the show today, Howden Rural, the new name for A-Plan Rural. If you follow Howden Rural on social media, you'll see the plethora of work that they do to support this sector, and it's been a pleasure to work alongside them so far, and long may it continue. For more information about them, be sure to check out howdeninsurance.co.uk/rural, and I'll see you for the next episode.